working correctly, and I can verify this pretty easily. Sounds like it's all right. Let me just begin then by saying that this is Thursday, January 24th, 1991, and this is Jim Boning talking to Professor Manson Benedict in Naples, Florida. Dr. Benedict, I know you were born in Lake Linden, Michigan on October 9th, 1907. Can you just tell me briefly something about your parents and their background, your family background?
Well, my mother was born in Syracuse in around 1872. She assisted her father, who was in the jewelry business, at a time when she wanted to go to college, and despite her father's serious objections, she accepted a New York State Regent scholarship and was admitted to Cornell University, where she studied for a couple of years before lack of funds required her to terminate her education after 2 years of study under Professor Hiram Corson, eminent authority on the poet Robert Browning, of whose poetry she was inordinately fond. My father was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1876, and of German immigrant parents, and who in a moment of misguided patriotism decided to give him the first name of Centennial because of the year of his birth, a name which he hated, and as a result he always went by his second name, which was Harry. So he signed himself C. Harry Benedict. He attended the public schools of Pittsburgh and received a scholarship which enabled him to study chemistry at Cornell University under Professor Louis Monroe Dennis, an eminent inorganic chemist. After a year of graduate study at Cornell, through Dennis's assistance, he received an offer of employment as metallurgist for the Calumet and Heckler. At that time, I think it was just called the Calumet and Heckler Copper Company in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So without any prior knowledge of what he was letting himself in for, he took this job in a rather remote and somewhat isolated region of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The copper company there had been in operation for some 50 years and had acquired an enormous pile of copper tailings, which still contained some 1% copper because of the inefficient nature of the extraction processes which had been used in the past. Processes which had been used in the past were all based on the difference in density or specific gravity of particles containing copper from those which just contained ordinary sand. And when the copper content of the sand got down to something like between 0.5% and 1%, there wasn't a sufficient difference in density to make it possible to provide more efficient separation. So the company decided that some chemically based process would be required to complete the extraction of the copper, and engaged my father to develop this process. Well, he put his knowledge of chemistry from Cornell to good use and found that acid extraction of the copper would not work very well because native copper is not soluble in acids without some oxidant. And but that the copper itself was soluble in solutions of cupric ammonium carbonate, which could be made from native copper itself. So he developed a leaching process which involved extracting the copper with the cupric ammonium carbonate and then taking the leach liquors which contained the extracted copper, but in the cuprous form. Distilling off the ammonia to recover copper oxide and reusing the ammonia to make more cupric ammonium carbonate. And that part of the process out of my mind now, but he, at any rate, it was based on the extraction of the ore with cupric ammonium carbonate and recycle of the ammonia. This enabled the company to recover some 30 million pounds of copper, which otherwise would have gone to waste, and was an important factor when the First World War started. My father's involvement in chemistry and his providing chemicals for us to, my brother and I, to work with in the basement laboratory caused me to become very enamored of chemistry. And I had no doubt whatever that I would use chemistry as my professional career. So, after I graduated from high school in 1923 and spent a year improving my undergraduate education and getting old enough to go to college by attending Shadyside Academy in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I entered Cornell University as an undergraduate in the fall of 1924.
Could I just interrupt for a moment? Then you had all of your public school education in Michigan.
All of my public school education was in Lake Linden, Michigan. That's
okay.
Right. But I did.
And then you spent the 1 year at
Shadyside Academy in Pittsburgh, which was pretty much a matter of marking time. It enabled me to grow up enough so that I was tall enough not to have to wear short pants when I went to Cornell and acquire a certain feeling of, well, self-confidence that enabled me to live away from home, because in the year at Pittsburgh I had spent weekends with my father's brothers in Pittsburgh, and it was kind of a transition period between being a small boy in a small town in Michigan and being a more mature person in the larger world.
Did you have any other chemistry experience besides what your father was doing for you in your own laboratory in high school?
Yes, through father. Let's see, when did I have my first job? No, I think I didn't have summer employment until after I had entered Cornell.
Okay.
But the father did give me an opportunity to, well, I do have a chapter on summer employment. Let me take a minute to look it up. Cut off your tape recorder while I see. Succession of summer jobs, mostly through the assistance of my father in getting employment with various divisions of the Calumet Heckler Copper Company. First job I had was assisting in the laboratory in taking samples of coal, which was delivered in about 100 shiploads per year at the company's docks, and crushing and grinding the coal. And see, we used a procedure called coning and quartering to obtain a small sample of coal from 100 tons or more, which was delivered to the docks, and then examining or analyzing the coal by we measured the heat of combustion, we measured the sulfur content of the coal, and determined whether it met the company's specifications. I also took samples of copper, ore and copper concentrates at various stages in the company's processing of the copper, from coarsely crushed ore down through fine sand and tailings, and assisted in the analysis of the materials and the leach liquors from the leaching process for copper content. This was good experience, and it just increased my interest in chemistry, which had been initiated by the basement chemistry laboratory my father equipped for me with a ChemCraft set and additional real acids and alkalis from the company's laboratory, which were not permitted to be sold in the ChemCraft set itself. You're probably familiar with what the ChemCraft sets consisted of. So there was never any doubt in my mind that I wanted to study chemistry, and I went to Cornell, where my father had self-graduated, where he had met my mother. I spent 4 years undergraduate education at Cornell, and did my undergraduate research under the same professor who had worked with whom my father had worked, Professor Louis Monroe Dennis. You've probably read all this in my chapter. You've seen this, haven't you?
No.
Oh, you haven't?
No. But that's all right. Whatever you want to give me will be fine, you know.
You'll have to make copies of all this stuff. Then. Well, do you want me to go over all just, this then?
Just briefly, I am interested in what Cornell was like at the time you were there, and what the curriculum was like and the kinds of courses you took. And
well, I was so completely enamored of chemistry that I signed up for the Bachelor of Chemistry program. The Bachelor of Chemistry program was a particular favorite of Professor Louis Monroe Dennis, the head of the chemistry department there, and he filled it so completely with chemistry subjects that I received a very poor liberal education. There was very little history, literature, mathematics, and more advanced physics required in the program, but the courses were such things as qualitative analysis, which was really quite helpful because it was a good way of learning inorganic chemistry, quantitative analysis, which would have been useful if I had worked as an analytical chemist in industry, but wasn't all that valuable as a knowledge of chemistry. Organic chemistry, which was valuable, taught by Professor William Orndorff, co-author of what was then the standard text in organic chemistry, Remsen and Orndorff. I don't know if you're familiar with that book or not, which didn't involve very much modern organic chemistry because Orndorff was an old man at that time. Physical chemistry, which was taught by Wilder Dwight Bancroft, who had very little respect for J. Willard Gibbs and any of the more advanced ideas in physical chemistry. and a lot of required courses in such subjects as gas and fuel analysis and other things, which might have been helpful to me had I been an analytical chemist in industry, but were very poor substitutes for a broader liberal education or a broader scientific education. The physics courses I had at Cornell were also very primitive and involved practically no introduction to quantum mechanics, which was just then becoming an important branch of physical science. So it was really a rather poor and one-sided chemistry education, and contained so very little in the liberal arts subjects that I was really very poorly equipped to become an effective member of modern society. Let me try to get my bearings straight on this.
You did do some research with Dennis.
Yes, I did some research with Dennis, which was very interesting and frustrating. Dennis was very fond of me, partly, I guess, because he remembered with pleasure the association he had with my father 25 years earlier, but also partly because I was so wrapped up in chemistry and was such a good student in the chemistry subjects that I was taught that he offered me in my senior year an opportunity to do research on a problem which had challenged him for some 30 years he'd been at Cornell, the production of carbon monosulfide. Dennis was a great believer in the regularities of the periodic table and reasoned with some justification that since carbon produced carbon monoxide, a gas with a boiling point of about -185, carbon dioxide, a gas with a boiling point of about -78, carbon disulfide, a liquid with a boiling point of about 35, I guess it was, that by analogy there ought to be a carbon monosulfide with a boiling point somewhere around that of carbon dioxide, about -75. And he had had a number of students trying to produce this gas without any great success. But he was very fond of me. I was a good student, and he decided to assign me for my senior research, which was part of the chemistry program, the production of carbon monosulfide. So, with Dennis's assistance, I tried various reactions that might have seemed successful, such as taking thiocarbonyl chloride and passing it over molecular silver to remove the chlorine. That didn't react at all. Reacting carbon bisulfide with carbon, and that didn't react at all. And trying to decompose carbon bisulfide vapor by passing it through an electric arc. So I designed a small glass vessel in which I inserted two carbon electrodes, put a liquid carbon bisulfide in it, cooled it down to -110 degrees centigrade, the freezing point of carbon disulfide, and struck an arc between the carbon electrodes and took the gas which came off into a cold trap cooled with liquid air. And I got a condensate, a white condensate, which certainly contained some vaporized carbon bisulfide, but which I hoped would also contain a carbon monosulfide because it's freezing, its condensing temperature would have been 80 or 90 degrees centigrade higher than the liquid air temperature. And then I was going to vaporize this mixture and fractionally distill the carbon monosulfide away from the carbon disulfide. So when I came to heat up the mixture, instead of getting anything off of the contents of the vessel that I had condensed the reaction products in, blew up with a flash of light. So it was clear that I had something new, but wasn't the stable compound that Dennis predicted carbon monosulfide would consist of. Well, when it blew up, it was converted into a brown reaction product, which I took out and analyzed by combustion analysis, and it had one atom of carbon to one atom of sulfur. So it was quite apparent that I had produced a unstable species, carbon monosulfide, which, when it was allowed to warm up, polymerized into a polymeric form with the same chemical formula. And I was highly elated because I was convinced that the first product I had made was carbon monosulfide, and I had some ideas, which probably wouldn't have been successful, about how to separate this from the unreacted carbon bisulfide and prove by spectroscopy or some other means that it was carbon monosulfide. But Dennis would have none of it. He was convinced that carbon monosulfide would be just as stable as carbon monoxide, and that the product that I had made was something that he had wanted and wasn't interested in. So he told me to give up that line of research and try various other reactions, none of which were successful. So the result of all this was I spent a year at Cornell after I got my bachelor's degree trying some of Dennis's proposed reactions, none of which worked, and becoming more and more convinced that I was on the wrong track, that chemistry wasn't all that fascinating after all, and that the world, which was by then going into a severe economic depression, had more needs for somebody as a social scientist than as a chemist, and that I was on the wrong track all along. So, after a year of unsuccessful research under Dennis, I gave up chemistry temporarily, and I had studied at, I have to look this up.
I was going to ask, how did you spend the 1 year just doing research for Dennis?
No.
Did you take any courses?
Yes, I did take some courses.
At the graduate level?
No, there were some of the undergraduate courses that I had not taken before.
I see.
Let me see what I have to say about that. Well, there's some interesting stuff in here that I should have told you. May I go back?
Certainly.
One of the reactions Dennis had me try was reacting thiophosgene, CsCl2, with molten sodium. That didn't work. But as I wrote here, I had a nasty disposal problem that I solved in a singularly inappropriate way. I took my 50 grams of unreacted sodium to the center of the bridge over Fall Creek and dropped it into the water. The hydrogen from the reaction exploded with a loud boom, and the sodium burned with a bright yellow flame in a cloud of sodium hydroxide. To dispose of the thiophosgene, a couple of my colleagues and I took a sealed glass bottle containing around a liter to the northwest corner of a field beyond Forest Home, which was an outlying suburb, where we thought a southwest wind was blowing towards some woods. We laid the bottles tenderly on the ground and a safe distance threw rocks at them. After they were broken, we walked back to the car 100 yards away To our dismay, we found that the wind had shifted and was blowing the smelly toxic stuff towards us in the nearby house. These were some of the things that an amateur chemist did.
That's excellent.
Well, at any rate...
How did you support yourself in that last year, at the fifth year at Cornell, after you had your degree?
Partly through my parents and partly through the summer employment I'd had at the Cadman Heckler Copper Company's laboratories. That summer employment was really excellent experience. First year, I simply was a sample boy in the laboratory and took samples. Have I been over this with you before?
Yeah.
I took samples of copper ore and tailings and solutions in the copper ammonia leaching plant that my father had developed and put into operation for the company, and took the samples to the laboratory and analyzed them for copper and other materials. Found that there was a certain amount of better turn it off for a minute while I try to remember it. This ties into my Cornell education, though. Professor Dennis at Cornell was a authority on the chemistry of germanium. He had done a lot of his own personal research on that, and I was interested to see if there was any germanium in the copper material. We found traces of it, but never enough to have involved the extraction process for removing the germanium from the copper ores. Better turn this off for a minute while I...
I'll just leave it running, and we'll just cut out all the blanks.
Right.
So that way I won't have to be... If that's all right with you,
sure.
Then we'll just cut out the blanks.
Sure. Yes, there were some minor constituents of the copper ore there, different from the native copper which the company was geared up to separate. And I was interested in getting samples of them, some of these. There was copper arsenides, and these were processed in the company smelter to oxidize. Oh dear, I can't remember how it worked, but at any rate, there were some byproduct materials at the smelter which might have contained traces of the element that was of interest to Dennis, germanium. So I got some samples of these and took them to the laboratory there and had them analyzed and found that they did indeed contain traces of germanium, and got some samples of copper arsenides that were in the ore in the first place, and found that it had minor amounts of germanium in them also. Dennis was looking for a local source of a domestic source of germanium, because most of the germanium that he'd worked with in the past came from Germany. But none of these were of high enough concentration to have been of any interest to the company to have extracted separately for Dennis.